Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is Science at Work, a Labor Day special from The Pulse at WHYY in Philadelphia. On any weekday in a big city, thousands of people are rushing to work in nice dresses, in their suits. There are construction workers, people wearing scrubs, carrying coffee cups, their lunch. A lot of them are wearing sneakers to get there faster, and off they all go into their office buildings, onto their hospital floor, or wherever their job takes them. On Labor Day, we celebrate all of these hardworking people who keep the engines of productivity humming. And during this hour, we'll dig into the science that keeps our workforce healthy and changes the way we work. We'll find out why cubicles make us feel boxed in and why taking time off makes us better workers. First up, if your work is trucking, then work is good right now. In 2013, more than $11 trillion worth of cargo crisscrossed the country by truck, and that number is estimated to almost double by 2040. This increase is in part due to all of the new ways we shop. Think Amazon Prime, personalized fashion sent straight to your home, or those meal kits to make dinner. But the trucking industry may be in for a wild ride and lots of changes in the near future, thanks to self-driving technology. So how's life on the road at this moment in time?
Okay, you want to jump up?
Reporter Alan Yu caught a ride.
Think about all those huge trucks on the road. They bring you pretty much everything you own, your phones, kitchen appliances, food, or they deliver them to the stores where you shop. There are people in those rigs doing the driving. Sometimes they feel a connection to what's in the back.
When the World Trade Center towers went down 9/11, we were actually picking up the body bags for New York City.
That's short-haul truck driver Bob Dolan. He's carried all sorts of things over the years. The body bags he's talking about were empty, going toward New York City, but still.
We were picking thousands of them up a day. You had this empty feeling, and we were still part of that whole process of the the cleanup, the closure.
All right, dispatch.
The stuff you love can't get to you without people.
My name is Shanira Scott Butler, and I am a woman truck driver.
Shanira has been driving a truck for 7 years. She's driven passenger buses and 18-wheelers across the country. She now drives a waste management trash truck outside Philadelphia. She replaces broken or dirty trash bins in front of your home with fresh, clean ones. She used to work at a nursing home, taking care of the frail and disabled. She liked doing that job.
But I wasn't making enough money. I was finding myself working every day, all day. You know, so I was working two jobs, Monday through Friday, and then a part-time job on Saturdays and Sundays. I was like, you know, I have to make a career change. Where do I want to go? So as I'm going through the newspaper, I see CDL driving. This is how much you can make. CDL driving, over the road.
CDL, that's commercial driver's license. A mid-range salary for a long-haul truck driver is around $41,000 a year, which is a lot more than you get for being a nursing assistant. So pretty good money, but maybe not so great for your health. Drivers sit a lot, and it's hard to exercise. And it's not easy to get fresh fruit or salad at a truck stop. Plus, there's safety issues. Modern trucks have collision avoidance, extra mirrors, but it takes a lot of skill to handle a vehicle that big.
I stand 5'2" or whatever, driving a 63-foot truck, loaded, 80,000 pounds sometimes.
One time she drove a truck up to New York and took her daughter with her.
My oldest was scared. And I remember her saying, "Mommy, do you know what you're doing?" And I said, "Yeah." "No, you don't. No, you don't." And she was like, "No, I don't want to get in the truck with you."
Shanira does know what she's doing, but humans make mistakes. Most crashes are caused by driver error. So car makers and tech companies are working on driverless cars and trucks. I spoke to Stefan Seltz-Axmacher. He co-founded the self-driving truck company Starsky Robotics, based in San Francisco. He says he wants to keep people in the virtual driver's seat, but get them out of the truck, kind of like military drone pilots.
And the way that we get there is we're making trucks drive themselves on the highway, but then be remote controlled or teleoperated for the first and last mile.
So the truck does the driving through the interstate where there are long straight roads, no pedestrians or bicycles that could get hit. The human takes over at the end of the trip near cities where navigation is harder. That way the drivers can be a lot more productive, like when agriculture went from farming by hand to using machines.
200, 300 years ago, it was very hard to farm more than like 100, 1,000 acres, just because there's only so much farming one person can do. And we just invented a tractor, and now a single person can farm 10,000 acres.
He says right now there are already trucks with his technology regularly hauling freight on the highways. But self-driving trucks and cars are only allowed in a handful of states, like Nevada and Michigan. Stefan is pretty adamant his technology won't make human drivers obsolete. Actually, he says his driverless trucks can improve working conditions for people.
We can make it so that these drivers can have, you know, normal hours and a normal life and still pay them well and treat them well and treat them with respect.
But
frankly, Alan, I've never heard such self-serving nonsense in my life.
That's Finn Murphy. He's been a truck driver for more than 30 years, and he wrote a book called The Long Haul.
Maybe your guy who's developing this doesn't want the driver gone, but the company he's going to be selling his machine to is certainly going to want the driver gone.
Finn thinks maybe Stefan's a little naive about this new technology not wiping out truck drivers.
Truck drivers need to be paid. They need vacations. They need time off. You need a whole compliance department. You need to follow the regulatory procedures. The whole point of automating the supply chain is to automate the supply chain.
Finn says he might get into trouble from other drivers for saying this, but he thinks self-driving trucks could have an upside. More than 4,000 people died in truck crashes in 2015. Driverless trucks don't guarantee perfect safety, but Finn says if they can reduce the people who die in truck crashes to the hundreds, then
our children's children are going to look at us and say, "You guys drove your own cars? You guys used pedals to go faster and pedals to stop, and you had a wheel? You people were savages."
But he says we also need to be concerned about the truck drivers who get left behind. Because for now, it's people who drive those trucks, bringing you that new phone, those shoes you bought online, and that hipster t-shirt you're wearing.
Alrighty, we are back.
For The Pulse, I'm Alan Yu.
Yeah. You ever driven one?
I have never driven one.
Never driven one? Do you want to drive one? It's automatic.
Yeah,
no?
That's a great idea.
Okay.
And what do truckers listen to on the road? Here's what truck driver and author of The Long Haul, Finn Murphy, says.
Every trucker I've ever known listens to the public radio. I try to time my driving to match Fresh Air with Terry Gross.
With Fresh Air.
In fact, I've got a little crush on Terry, probably because I think I've spent more time with Terry Gross than anyone else in my whole life. Classic
blues and rhythm and blues. I also just loved this lady in Alan's story.
Shanira Scott Butler, and I am a woman truck driver.
Women are still a small minority in trucking, but 50 years ago, female truck drivers were pretty much unheard of. Unions fought against them entering this profession because they thought women couldn't handle it. That notion is, of course, a familiar one in the history of labor. Women trying to make their way in and being told, no, it's too hard for you. In the Victorian era, one female physician used science to try to put an end to this narrative.
Mary Putnam Jacobi was arguably one of the most important women in the United States in the 19th century.
That's Carla Biddle. She is a history professor at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles.
Jacobi was a real force behind the advancement of women in science and medicine, and also a political activist as well.
Carla says that in Mary's time, many women were kept out of school and prevented from working in medicine or in the sciences because of their period. The prevailing science then, which wasn't backed by evidence, said that menstruation made women too fragile for intellectual work.
And a lot of physicians believe that the body had only so much energy, like a fixed amount, and that women, by diverting it to education and mental work, were actually putting themselves at great physical risk, and that they needed to save their energy for the reproductive functions of their bodies.
So what did Mary Putnam Jacobi do?
Well, what's so interesting is that she argued the opposite. While some said that the brain was draining of a female energy, Jacobi said that women's bodies needed mental stimulus. In fact, if women were sick, she said, it was because they were not educated enough, that they were not physically active enough, and that it was sort of the comforts of middle-class life that in many ways were not giving them enough energy.
Mary Putnam Jacobi published an essay on the topic called The Question of Rest for Women During Menstruation. How did she go about collecting research and data for this?
She began with a questionnaire at the time to ask women to report on very sort of private matters was not common, but she asked them to describe their experience during menstruation.
Does pain exist between menstrual periods? Has it been necessary to rest during period? If so, how long? When did this first become necessary? Has any change taken place since 20 in color, flesh, or strength?
And then she also traced pulse rates. And she did this over the course of a month and showed that actually pulse rates increased before menstruation. And that, she said, was a positive thing. It was actually showing that women were vital. And she really tried to connect it to other functions of the body that men experienced too. She said menstruation in some ways was like digestion. It was a natural reoccurring process in the body, and one did not need to rest every time after a meal. So in the same way, women did not need to rest during menstruation.
What do we know about how her research on this topic impacted perceptions of women and women in the workforce?
Well, I would say that she was one of the most important voices in challenging the notion of female physical inferiority. And it was really a contestation. It was really a battle over the meaning of female biology. But what's important is, I think, is she inspires other women practitioners and health educators who are really interested in describing menstruation in more normalized terms. And they also really see that by doing that, that's important for women's access to other activities and changing the way people perceive women's health.
That's historian Carla Biddle. She's the author of Mary Putnam Jacobi and the Politics of Medicine in 19th Century America. A lot of us spend our days in cubicles behind drab, fabric-covered walls, and this setting seems to inspire a deep existential angst in terms of our lives and what we're doing with our time. The cult classic Office Space perfectly captured this feeling.
We don't have a lot of time on this earth. We weren't meant to spend it this way. Human beings were not meant to sit in little cubicles staring at computer screens all day, filling out useless forms and listening to eight different bosses drone on about mission statements.
But don't blame the cubicle itself for all of your woes, says Nikhil Saval. He's the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace.
The sort of dread and unhappiness that people associate with cubicles, it's not exactly just about the space itself, and it's not purely a design issue. it's just a symbol of a broader workplace problem.
A symbol of being boxed in with no opportunities for growth. But Nikhil says it was never meant to be this way.
So the story of the cubicle is very interesting.
The cubicle was created by a designer working at Herman Miller, a furniture company.
Whose name is Robert Probst. What he conceived of was not actually called the cubicle. He had something called the action office, this hinged three-walled structure that was meant to be very flexible. It could be shaped to have an individual office space, or it could be shaped to create a meeting. And the emphasis really was on action. I mean, if you look at images of it, people were constantly in motion in these spaces.
Each office is a mind-oriented action arena to provide privacy without isolation, involvement without a loss of individuality.
This is an infomercial from the Herman Miller archives. The new buzz phrase back then was knowledge work, and action office was supposed to facilitate a free flow of ideas and creativity.
It's a far better environment for today's changing functions. An instant, flexible office facility that can parallel the surging, turbulent business life it serves. This is indeed the age of change.
Action Office debuted in 1964.
It was deemed one of the most interesting and successful office designs ever, but it was copied very quickly by other office companies. And as they installed more and more of these into office spaces, they ended up becoming much more box-like because the managers found that it was actually an incredible tool for cramming as many people as possible, as cheaply as possible, into as little space as possible. So by the 1980s, Probst's design had become known as the cubicle.
So I'm not sitting in an action office, I'm sitting in a cubicle. I like, action office sounds cooler though.
I mean, the action office, it looked cooler at the time. You know, it was a very 60s idea, actually. It's autonomy, individualism. It's, you know, it's meant to liberate office workers, not to box them in.
These days, a lot of companies are taking down cubicle walls in favor of a more open floor plan. And some workplaces take things one step further.
People don't really have desks of their own. And this is already very commonplace in sort of future-minded offices, where people just come in and they take any desk that they want. Everything is sort of cloud-based. It's increasingly paperless, and it's increasingly nomadic.
Nikhil says employees tend to hate this design because they have trouble concentrating and there's absolutely no privacy. Working together in tight spaces, cubicle walls or not, also creates a hotbed for tensions.
Power struggles, taking credit for other people's work. People get very exercised over things like stealing food from the refrigerator, not flushing the toilet, whatever it may be.
That's psychiatrist Jody Foster. Her book is The Schmuck in My Office. And Jody has done a lot of consulting for companies that are struggling with difficult employees.
The overbearing, egocentric person who is bowling everyone over, filling the room up with him or herself, flying off the handle easily. Those are the most common stories, without question.
And what do we do with that?
What I found, I've done so many of these consults at this point. The people who are having these problems in the office, they're not sick. They're not mentally ill. They're just people who are bringing their personalities to work with them. And they work fine in other areas of their lives, but perhaps not in this particular culture.
When the disruptive person is being told, hey, other people think you are a jerk.
Yeah.
What do they say? Are they surprised?
Well, so that's such an interesting question because the data actually shows that people who are given an awareness interview in an overwhelming...
Is that an intervention?
Yes, it is. In an overwhelming majority of cases, they will self-correct because they didn't particularly know that the way they were being was causing trouble, which I'm sure to the people for whom it's causing trouble, they can't believe that, but many people are pleased to find that this was just something that they didn't know about or that they didn't know was right in a particular culture because it's just the way they act.
Psychiatrist and business consultant Jody Foster is the author of The Schmuck in My Office. We're exploring how science changes the way we work, and one thing scientists are learning is that all of us should work a lot less. only to be more productive when we do work, of course. My friends in Europe seem to be forever on vacation somewhere, but Americans are terrible at taking time off, even if they have paid vacation. Last year, over half of US workers didn't use all of their vacation days, and those who do go somewhere have trouble unplugging, Shuka Kalantari reports.
Marianne Dakek is a family doctor in Washington, D.C. She's always on call, even when she's away from the hospital. Her work pager gets rerouted to her personal cell phone.
So every beep has the same urgency. Every text has the same urgency. Every phone call has the same urgency.
She's also the mother of two young kids. Plus,
I teach, therefore I have about 21 extra children who are called residents in the work life. And I also have two children who are called children in their work life.
When she takes a vacation, it's hard for her to unwind at first. She recently drove 6 hours to a campout in tents with friends and family in upstate New York, near a river surrounded by oaks and maples. I asked Marianne to keep an audio journal to track whether she was really unwinding or if she was still plugged into her smartphone. And her friends with her on the trip kept tabs on her too.
I have checked my work email, unfortunately. I've responded to one resident text, breaking rules.
Wait, they texted you?
They do text me.
Which one? Text, so you're never off.
No, I'm never off.
That was day one. On day two, Marianne began to relax.
I actually slept through the night. I actually slept in past 6 a.m., both of which are big successes since many times I don't do either of those.
When we don't get a break, our bodies, our nervous systems, get stuck in something called sympathetic mode.
Human bodies are meant to respond to threats, respond to challenges, and then recover from them. So vacation is kind of like that break.
That's Emiliana Simon-Thomas. She's a science director at the University of California, Berkeley. She says when we're in sympathetic mode, our hearts race, muscles tense up, our brains tell us, get ready to fight or flee. It's the body's evolutionary response to danger, a safety mechanism from back when our ancestors were being chased by tigers.
The assumption physiologically is that those threats are not pervasive, that those threats are not enduring, that they don't go on and on and on. Either you perish or you survive and the threat goes away.
Anxiety over impending deadlines, anticipated failures. We're on constant alert for the next 21st century threat, and our bodies can't hang. They need rest to do things like digest food, stabilize blood pressure, and repair damaged tissue. When we're stressed, our bodies don't get the memo to do this repair work.
It's like, hold on, we're not going to do that for a while. We're just going to deal with this challenge right in front of us.
Some workers around the country have a tough time taking vacation. San Francisco has the worst track record. 62% of employees in the Golden City who work 35 hours or more report not taking all their paid time off. I'm at the San Francisco office of the software company Adobe Systems. Rosemary Arriata-Kuiper leads human resources here. She tells me Adobe used to have a hard time getting employees out of the office.
When somebody goes on vacation, you may go on vacation and you may disconnect, but everything around you still goes on. So when you come back to the office, guess what? You're going through 100 emails, you're trying to play catch up.
We're in a huge cafeteria where employees are drinking coffee on plush couches and working on their laptops in corner booths. Rosemary says twice a year this place goes silent. Everyone takes a mandatory vacation and Adobe closes shop.
The beauty of the shutdown is it allows everybody to kind of disconnect at the same time and for an extended period of time so that people actually feel like they have the opportunity to recharge.
The media company TED of TEDx also has these blackouts. So does LinkedIn and smaller companies like Arizmendi, a local bakery in the Bay Area. For many businesses, this mandatory time off came out of the recession 10 years ago. It was a way to cut costs, but the policy stuck because research shows taking all your allotted vacation time is not only good for your health, it's good for a company's bottom line. Productivity increases, employee retention goes up. It's a win-win. Back to Marianne Dakek, the doctor and mother of two who went on that nature getaway in upstate New York. She says halfway through vacation, a folk band played at their campsite. She danced, she ate, she drank, and she rested. She stopped being on call.
End of the vacation. Tomorrow I go back to work. And what I really feel more than anything else from this 4-day vacation is clarity, which for me is very energizing.
Managing residents at a busy hospital, caring for patients, Marianne says her time away gave her the reboot she needed to get back to work. For The Pulse, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
I'm Mike and Scott. This is a Labor Day special from The Pulse. And while we're on the topic of keeping the working masses healthy, a lot of us have health care thanks to our jobs. It's a benefit we get through work, part of our compensation, and that has advantages and downsides. Here now to talk more is Marketplace healthcare reporter Dan Gorenstein. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Maiken.
So, Dan, this connection between work and insurance is one of the toughest political topics of our time. How did we end up with this system where so many other industrialized countries have a national health plan?
Right. Well, so our system, this employer-sponsored system, we have 175 million Americans who get their insurance this way. And it's really just this major part of what our system is built on. And, you know, how we got there, it's all part of this historical quirk. It's kind of crazy. And really, to tell this story, Mike, it starts out, like all good stories do, by a fire.
The major objectives of a sound manpower...
It's October 1942. In this fireside chat, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt describes a growing war.
With every passing week, the war increases in scope and intensity. That is true in Europe, in Africa, in Asia, and on all the seas.
At home, there's also a battle for workers. So many men are abroad that businesses are desperate for employees, and health economist Sherry Gleed says they're willing to pay.
Remember, you're coming out of the Depression, all of a sudden hiring ramps up, and wages start to climb, and prices start to climb.
In that October chat, the president makes the case economic sacrifices at home are needed as much as any new tank.
We shall be compelled to stop workers from moving from one war job to another as a matter of personal preference. To stop employers from stealing labor from each other.
That year, the National War Labor Board forbids employers from raising their workers' salaries, a wage cap. Look, if our employer-sponsored insurance system has an origin story, it's this. You've got the wage cap, but the labor board rules health insurance is exempt, so insurance gains a new kind of currency. Plus, the IRS decides employer contributions to health insurance premiums are tax-free, which means workers pay less out of their own pocket. This all happens as a medical miracle unfolds. The arrival of penicillin.
Industrial monument to the miracle drug. Mass production penicillin plant at Terre Haute, Indiana. One of many where the life-saving medicine is now being manufactured.
All of a sudden, Americans could go to the hospital and get antibiotics, curing them from things like strep throat and staph infections, which until recently had been everyday killers. So health insurance becomes more important and employers start to dangle fat insurance contracts to attract the best and the brightest. Unions embrace the employer system too, says Miami of Ohio economic historian Melissa Thomason.
Unions have always been concerned about being able to offer workers benefits, right? That's the reason for their existence. And so unions in the 1940s began trying to negotiate for health insurance on behalf of their members.
Within a decade after Roosevelt's fireside chat, private health insurance has exploded.
How many people have this important private health insurance? Only 8 million people in 1939. But in 1952, 92 million.
That's Ovetta Kolbhabi. She was President Dwight Eisenhower's Secretary for the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. In that speech, Hobby was pitching Eisenhower's plan to expand insurance to the millions of Americans without coverage. This is the third try passing some kind of national health plan since the end of the war, and to join most other Western nations. But economist Melissa Thomason says each time doctors, through their lobbying group, the American Medical Association, launch scorched earth campaigns.
Doctors have always worried that it would limit their ability to charge patients what they wanted. And they're heavily lobbying government. They say that if health insurance is nationalized, it's likely that government won't stop there. They'll start nationalizing other industries too. So they use the fear factor to kill it.
She says by the mid-50s, the economy hums along. People want new Fords, the best medical care, shiny everything. Like this ad says, go ahead, pour yourself a cold golden Budweiser.
Live life, every golden minute of it. Enjoy Budweiser, every golden drop of it.
When it comes to healthcare, lots of Americans drink up all they see. Employer-sponsored insurance made healthcare cheap. Monthly premiums for an upstate New York 1950s Blue Cross Blue Shield family plan runs $6.80. That's $60 in today's terms. Millions of workers ended up with more generous coverage than they actually needed, says economist Sherry Gleed.
That's the fundamental economic problem, that people are just making excessive use of it because, in the language that people talk about today, they don't have enough skin in the game. They're not paying enough of their own cost, and so they're overusing services.
So, Dan, how does overusing healthcare services drive up overall costs?
So what ends up happening is when we've got sort of all this money to burn, it's sending a signal to the doctors and the hospitals, the drug makers and the medical device manufacturers that we are in the market for care and devices and drugs. And so they respond. They make stuff. They develop things. Some of these things are amazing and then they're life-saving. Some of these things aren't so great. They don't do that much at all.
So my doctor might say, you know what? Let's get an MRI. Your insurance covers it. Go ahead.
Exactly. And you're thinking to yourself, sure, it's not going to cost me anything, right? So when you have this overly generous plan where you don't see any of the costs, you think, okay, that's fine. I'll get one MRI, I'll get another MRI. And because there's so many people getting these MRIs, that tells the hospital, we need more MRI machines.
So it feeds, the engine feeds itself.
Precisely.
Your story really brought to light for me how ingrained the system is in our country and how previous administrations tried to untangle this helix of health insurance and employment and failed. So are we stuck with this?
You know, I think there's one way to think about that question is to think about the experience that we have had with the Cadillac tax. That's a provision included in the Affordable Care Act that taxes really generous plans. And when this tax was supposed to go into effect, unions pushed back, employers pushed back, members of Congress pushed back, and it's been delayed to now it's supposed to take effect in 2020. Who knows if it'll ever take effect? But the point is, lots of people are really invested in this employer system. So when there's all this sort of talk politically about Medicare for all, I think one thing that people need to remember is that changing this employer system would be a massive disruption to people. And that, I think, needs to be a part of the debate.
So a major disruption to our lives.
For those 175 million people, no doubt.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Mikan.
I'm Mikan Scott, and we're exploring science that's changing how we work. There's a lot of research on the importance of employment for people with mental illnesses. Having a job means having structure. It can be meaningful. It makes people feel less isolated. But keeping a job when you're struggling with severe depression or anxiety is a whole other story. Should you be honest about what's going on? How do you take time off for therapy? Will your boss be understanding? In a recent survey by the American Psychological Association, most people said their employers don't offer enough resources to support mental health needs. But that culture may be changing. Alana Gordon reports.
For as long as she can remember, Madeline Parker has always been anxious, even as a kid. But by college, she wasn't sure she'd survive.
I have multiple school notebooks that have half-finished suicide notes in them.
Wow.
I'm a little bit shocked that I made it through.
Along the way, she was diagnosed with severe depression. But she did graduate with a computer science degree from Michigan State in 2013. And right after that, she landed a job at this software company, Olark. It has an office in Ann Arbor.
It gave me new life. I was so happy to have this job. I was so happy to feel valued right away.
Things were great, but then they weren't. Her depression meds stopped working. Madeline started calling in sick. She kept the specifics of why a secret.
I mean, this isn't something that you normally talk about at work. And the way that it presents makes me look like either I'm lazy or I don't care or I'm bad at my job. And so I was putting all of this pressure on myself, and it absolutely crushed me.
After a lot of back and forth, Madeline decided to tell her supervisor what was really going on. The response floored her.
He said, "I wonder who else feels like this. We should make sure that they know that it's okay to take care of themselves and to take time off for this."
What was it like to hear that?
I was absolutely blown away because I was prepared for, you might be fired.
Word got up to the CEO, Ben Congleton. We called him up in San Francisco.
Hi, this is Ben.
Hi, Ben, it's Madeline.
Hi, Madeline.
I don't know, I just feel for, Madeline, I feel for what you were going through, like feeling this guilt and this anxiety. It just sort of pains me to think about people working at places where they feel like they have to hide an aspect of who they are.
Ben says the reality is mental illness is common. He views it as no different than when a worker has a physical health condition, like the flu or diabetes.
And I think part of the reason mental health feels like something that's different from the flu is because we haven't really talked about it a lot.
But Ben's response isn't just about being a good guy. Dr. Arthur Evans, head of the American Psychological Association, says research has found that creating a work environment that supports people who have mental illnesses is actually good for business.
Employers who have initiatives that recognize that their employees' well-being is important tend to have much better employee outcomes, like job satisfaction, ability to do their job well.
And he says this isn't necessarily a huge resource lift. It's about changing the culture.
What it really requires is the support of senior management.
He says bosses who recognize workplace stressors and help reduce them, like by allowing more flexible time off or telecommuting, tend to have more productive employees. But for a lot of people, that's just not a reality. It certainly wasn't for Destiny Campanella.
None of my supervisors or bosses or anybody was ever understanding of my mental illness. They just believed in, I guess, tough love, you want to call it, pushing me.
Destiny's 27 and lives in Philadelphia. She has severe depression and PTSD from an abusive relationship. She works as an advocate now for people with mental illnesses. But before that, she had jobs at a restaurant, a daycare, places that tend to have fewer worker benefits. And she says she really struggled to get accommodations for things like therapy appointments.
I felt so misunderstood. They made me feel worse. I thought, am I ever going to be able to hold down a job?
Destiny says she barely made it through. But she also learned some important lessons, like that self-care is not selfish. She found creative ways to make time for herself.
Some days I would even lock myself in that bathroom and just say, I need a moment.
But there are protections that are supposed to be in place for employees.
People can request what's called a reasonable accommodation.
Alyssa Schatz is policy director at the Mental Health Partnership in Philadelphia. She worries that mental health discrimination is still an issue, and that a lot of people may not be aware of protections like the Family Medical Leave Act, or that legally they have the right to request certain things on the job.
So if you're taking a medication that's making you feel drowsier, you might be able to flex your schedule to come in at a later time.
As for Madeline in Michigan, she still has a lot of ups and downs that bleed into work. Her depression and anxiety haven't magically gone away.
God, just last week, I was in the middle of a meeting and I was getting close to having a panic attack.
But
I was able to excuse myself and say, hey, I am feeling really anxious. I need to go for a walk. And no one batted an eye. And that's huge.
And then earlier this summer, when things got real rough, she sent this email.
So I said, hey, team, I'm taking today and tomorrow to focus on my mental health. Hopefully I'll be back next week refreshed and back to 100%. Thanks, Madeline.
To her surprise, she got this response from Ben, the CEO.
Hey, Madeline, I just wanted to personally thank you for sending emails like this. Every time you do, I use it as a reminder of the importance of using sick days for mental health.
I can't believe this is not standard practice in all organizations. You're an example to us all and help cut through the stigma so that we can bring our whole selves to work.
And then I thought that was pretty special.
Now, if like me, you're feeling a little overwhelmed right now with warm, fuzzy feelings, consider yourself warned, because the story does not stop there. Madeline had already started being more open about managing her illness at work. She even presented at tech conferences on the topic. And this email exchange really moved her. She decided to take to social media. She shared a screenshot of the email exchange in a tweet to her, 300 or so followers. It appears to have struck a nerve. What kind of response did you get? Like a few dozen?
I mean, I'm still getting notifications about this. Right now, I have 550 replies, 16,400 retweets, and 45,300 likes.
Wow.
I really was not expecting anything like this.
Both say never underestimate the power of just one exchange, of just one voice of a worker or boss, and helping open up a much bigger conversation. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Sticking with this feel-good moment, many of us love our jobs. We find them meaningful and rewarding. Yes, even when the work is hard, annoying, and stressful. Let's hear from an emergency room doctor who handles a lot of tough stuff, and still, he loves his job.
I think there's a real perception that there's an explanation for everything, and one of the old lines in medicine is that medicine is the show that physicians put on while nature takes its course. My name is Tom Martin. I'm an emergency physician at UPMC Presbyterian Hospital in Pittsburgh. I started working exclusively nights in September of 1998. We had our third and fourth children, twins, and so we now had four children who were all under eight. And what doing nights let me do was have a predictable schedule and be there in the evening to have dinner and do homework. So I start at 11 p.m. and it takes me 25 minutes to drive here. And maybe part of that is just trying to get your head in the game before you show up. The case that you're not going to understand as quickly as you should, the procedure that might not go as you expect. The nature of emergency medicine is that you have to be all in from the minute you hit the door. Everybody comes to an emergency department for a reason. Even when the reason is something simple, often patients are bringing that challenge of not only being sick, but being frightened. And I think if you can let them know that you see them as something more than their illness or their problem, I think it lets them take a deep breath. I can remember a night maybe 15 years ago, and it was a patient that had end-stage congestive heart failure, and the woman had decided that she had come in several times in a row and had to have a breathing tube put in, and she had decided that she was not going to do that anymore. And so she came in, and it was obvious that this was going to be the moment, and she came in with her husband. So what happened was it was snowy, so the ED was empty, and I ended up sitting with the woman's husband. While his wife was dying, he was sort of telling me about his wife's life. It seems like almost every patient I take care of has an incredible story, and at night, the staff obviously shrinks. There's fewer patients, so it's a different feel at night. I still really love what I do. I guess I like the idea of being able to help people. So I think in 10 years I will definitely still be doing emergency medicine, and in 10 years I really hope that I'd still be doing nights. I think I really could do it.
Tom Martin is an emergency physician. Margaret J. Krause from our partner station WESA in Pittsburgh produced this story. Labor Day celebrates workers, but it's also a signpost that one season is ending and another one is beginning. I was at the beach last weekend. The weather was lovely. The water felt silky and warm. The sky was that perfect shade of blue. And there was a cover band playing in a pavilion nearby. Maybe it was the song or the lyrics or just the fact that I knew these beautiful warm days are about to run out, but suddenly I was overcome by a feeling of dread that I call end of summer sadness. I talked to my favorite shrink about this, psychologist Dan Gottlieb. Dan, do you think end of summer sadness is real? Is it a thing?
Yeah, it's a thing.
But he says we're not just mourning the end of warm weather and the longer days.
It's the fact or the illusion of less work. And I tell myself, summer's coming, I'm going to do less work. I'm going to have more leisure time. Of course, it never happens. But, you know, it's the end of that grand delusion.
Dan tries to remind himself of a piece of advice he got from a friend years ago.
Don't postpone joy.
And don't try to cram it all into summer.
And what is it we're ultimately looking for? Ultimately, is rest and relaxation. Giving ourselves a break. That's what we're looking for.
And joy.
Yeah, well, that comes as a byproduct.
So we can have joy in the fall and we even get to wear sweaters.
Exactly, exactly. Take joy in your sweater.
Don't ever miss a moment of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.